And our challenge after the first year and a half of working directly at police station level in the States was to look at how police went about their daily business. What methods did they use to go about their business? What did they do when people came into the station to report an incident? What did that mean, particularly for those groups like the women and children who were vulnerable, who wouldn't necessarily go to the police for access? How could we make that facility more attractive to them? And they would get a positive response from that. And in our sort of first 18 months of work, we looked at the processes of policing service delivery, if you want to call it. It sounds very grand for what is a very simple process in reality. And we found across the country in the various states we were working quite a commonality of process, which was quite encouraging given the conflicts and the upheaval of South Sudan in the past 25, 30 years. And we used that as a way of driving a policy and of driving standard operating procedures. And what we wanted to do was to make sure that any policies or any processes attached to providing access to justice for women and girls and vulnerable people was not something that was exceptional. It was something which became part of the mainstream policing process. And that was quite a difficult thing. It was very easy to pump resources in through particular units dedicated to children or dedicated to women or dedicated to certain types of victims, and ignore the basic processes of law, processes of policing service. So our process was to try and put the vulnerable groups component and policy onto a community policing process, which in itself was quite a new concept for South Sudan. For those of you who know Sudan and South Sudan, community policing had a sort of national security and sort of political control label attached to it. So community policing in South Sudan had to be rethought in the way it was delivered, and the engagement of the police in the community wasn't on a sort of state level. It was trying to get the police to talk to those who they worked and lived with. And in that process, trying to put together a set of sort of incident and custody and investigation protocols in the police, very basic ones that we could train to and mentor, that allowed victims of violence or victims, women and children of vulnerable groups particularly, to receive and be alerted into a sort of slightly wider sphere of support and process. And that involved getting the police locally and nationally to talk to the various ministries and other entities providing joint care, and in particular some of the UN agencies who are helping to fund some of this. So the likes of UNFPA, UNICEF, UN, the obvious partners, UNPOL, the various, and the bilateral donors who are working. Whether that was effective or not, history will tell us, I suppose. We were very much encouraged after December 2013 when we had to leave because of political crisis, and we found that when we went back 4 or 5 months later, many of the mechanisms that we put in place at the station level, again with support from a lot of the bilaterals and the other international agencies, were working. A lot of the training material that was now used as standard training for recruits and within the police itself and supported by the international partners included components for community policing, and particularly for all of the vulnerable groups. And we found that that was ongoing, and those units were still working. Exacerbated in places because of the IDP camps and the massive migrations of people away from their normal environments. And that in itself caused a massive issue for the police. They were unable to mobilize their resources to respond to that. And in fact, I think even UNPOL and UNMISS have had problems trying to provide access to particularly women and girls in the camps that they are managing, because they fall outside of South Sudan law in many respects and UN territory. And that has caused a big problem. There were various, before we left on our program at the end of June, there were a number of initiatives being sort of started and are now ongoing with international agencies, and particularly with UNPOL and UNMISS, on getting the police able to provide some of those services and working with other agencies like the local government ministries to try and provide some service to the camps, but at the same time not sort of ignoring what's happening in the local communities and in the areas where initiatives have started. In summary then, I'm sorry it's not longer, I'd like to carry on forever really. In summary, from a development point of view, we found a number of big challenges. The biggest ones, I think, were trying to match the short-term aims of a sort of post-conflict environment and donors' needs to what is effectively a very slow cultural change process. Cultural change within the organisation, working with the cultural change in society and within government as well. We realised there was a need for wide levels of engagement. Those take a lot of resources and time and need a lot of networking. And also the need for upholding the law, using the law and existing processes as a structure from which to develop both what happens formally but also what happens informally within the traditional sector. Managing expectations was a difficulty, both within the partners, other bilaterals, but our partners, our counterpart partners as well. There was an expectation you could throw money at things and things would happen, and that wasn't our experience, and it wasn't something we tried to encourage either. Which meant that often we were having, as a project, to work with and mitigate donor and international partners' conflicting interventions. And I say that carefully, because we had our own expectations, some of them short-term, some of them long-term. I think our donors and our international partners, and particularly some of the UN agencies, had very conflicting processes and interventions and shorter visions. There's nothing wrong with that, but when you're talking about long-term cultural change, both in an organisation and in the sort of legal process, it often helps to have a more cohesive long-term view. And for us, and as a statement I'll leave on the table, for discussion, I really appreciate some views on this, and I'm happy to try and sort of contribute to that debate as well, is really in terms of our funding from DFID and the contribution we had from DFID and the SEO and our project. And don't worry, Atos, I'm not going to be contentious on this one. We felt that there was almost a conflict between some of the long-term development aims that the DFID have in this sector with a long-term vision for 10 to 20 years worth of support into policing and the changes that needed to happen around society on that. A number of interventions that they were doing alongside policing that were particularly relevant to providing, if you like, support for the vulnerable groups of society. And we felt there was a massive conflict between DFID and the Foreign Office and between policy within the British government as to how that should happen. And I guess for us, the sort of kick in the solar plexus was in June 2014. As politically, our programme was not extended. We were hoping to get an extension. We've done all the work to do so. And the police particularly encouraged us and wanted that. The IGP had come to London to actually speak to people in DFID as well, at the encouragement of DFID and the Foreign Office in Juba, to try and keep the programme going, to keep those interventions, particularly around human rights and around the support to vulnerable groups. And that was withdrawn at the last minute, just as our programme was ending, and at the same time as we had the international conference here in London on access to justice for women and girls in conflict environments. So for us, that was a massive blow. The encouraging thing was the police have gone ahead with that themselves, and there are different interventions in country on a smaller scale to provide some support into the police and to provide a catalyst into some of the UN agencies and international agencies to keep this going. But it could have been so much more. We felt that was a big contradiction in terms of objectives. And that's the sort of statement I'd like to leave on the table, because I think that's something that should be adjusted, it should be debated, and it should be brought up. I don't know if there's an answer to it. It's something which we feel compromises programming, and if you're doing development is a long-term thing. So my apologies if that was a bit sort of rapid and sort of rather schizophrenic in this approach, but I'm happy to sort of feel anything that later on if you have.
Great, thanks. Did you want to introduce your video, or do you want to go straight
into it? I guess I'll give a couple of lines of background.
Yeah, well, sure.
Yeah. Well, thank you for ODI for hosting us, and thanks for your being here. Today I'm presenting what a peace-building programme in Pakistan is undertaking in relation to security and justice for women and girls. So firstly, I'd like to show a short video. It gives some background and insight into the work we're doing with women. And for those of you that don't know, we're working mainly in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa, which is the border region between Pakistan and Afghanistan. Then I'll give a brief overview of the programme and go on to the challenges that we're experiencing. I'll be giving an account of strategies that are being used, currently being used. This is an active DFID programme. And then following on, it would be very interesting to hear your views and on how this could be improved and perhaps some experiences in other countries as well. So if we could thank you. So as we all know, increasing security and justice for women and girls is a policy priority. The UK National Action Plan on Women, Peace and Security this year has outlined the importance of involving women in peace-building efforts. excluding women means excluding the experiences